This week on Your Western Context, the Safe Third Country Agreement is ruled unconstitutional. The military warned the government about COVID-19 on January 17th, and only one returning ISIS fighter is subject to criminal charges. Also, Bill Morneau forgets to pay for a $41,000 We Charity vacation. This is Western Context, episode 179, recorded Friday, July 24th, 2020. The Recusal Refusal. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us for another episode of Western Context. Patrick and myself are back, as we are each and every weekend here, and we're going to run through the news of the week and talk about some stories that go back to the very beginning of this podcast.
Yes, that's for sure. Some that go all the way back. Some that have been surfacing in the news over the past couple weeks as well. And there's certainly been a lot of news that's cropped up this summer, much more than there usually is. And a lot that we could talk about. And it was actually kind of tough narrowing down what we were going to actually mention on the podcast, given there's a lot of news that the media has not been giving its full attention to.
That's right. And, you know, if you're joining us for the first time, Western Context is a podcast that aims to cut through all that media bias and sensationalism that you find in the news, whether you're reading it on the internet or watching it on your TV. And in doing so, hopefully we'll be able to provide all the information and context necessary to put you on the right side of the news. And we're going to begin with one of those stories that goes back all the way back to January of 2017 here. And this was one of our very first early stories here on the podcast, and this is, of course, referring to the huge influx in illegal asylum seekers or illegal border crossers that were coming into Canada on our southern border, or as the government of Canada preferred to call them, irregular border crossers. Now, this, of course, back then was spurred by Justin Trudeau's Welcome to Canada tweet that was issued the weekend after Donald Trump's presidential inauguration. And, you know, this, of course, was in response to Trump's Muslim ban, as the media called it, even though President Barack Obama, in his previous term, had issued similar bans on travel from Muslim-majority countries. But of course, that's neither here nor there. Over the years since then, we have taken in over 58,000 irregular border crossers here in Canada. And that's what the government and RCMP call them. And, you know, we're going to break down these numbers because we haven't looked at these numbers in a while, and they are truly astounding. Of those 58,000 or so, 14,420 have been accepted, while only 11,948 have been rejected, as in sent back, and 29,605 of those claims are still pending, meaning those folks get to reside here in Canada. Now, to date, here in 2020, 3,094 people have been intercepted by the RCMP. Now, it gets slightly worrying, though, at this point, because we are, of course, in the midst of the pandemic. And in April of 2020, the statistics that the RCMP have list that only six people were intercepted in the month of April. 21 were intercepted in May and 32 in June. Now, these numbers are down, way down from what we saw prior to the start of the pandemic. And in March, we saw 955 intercepted, 980 in February, and 1,100 in January. So, you know, there's obviously some questions to be asked. Why did these numbers effectively hit the floor, going from 955 one month down to just six the next month? And, you know, anybody who uses their brain will see that this suggests, of course, that the government has just stopped caring about people coming in illegally on our southern border. And perhaps the RCMP have been issued an order to not intercept them or invoke the Safe Third Country Agreement. Now, you're probably wondering, why are we talking about this? Why are we talking about this story again here? We have the pandemic, we have the wee fiasco or scandal going on, as is happening in the federal government. And, you know, some people in the CBC even called it an interaction, is to minimize that. But we'll save that, of course, for our firing line. 3 weeks running on that, which is absolutely astounding. But nonetheless, the Safe Third Country Agreement, the subject of this story, has been ruled unconstitutional here in Canada by the Federal Court of Appeal. Now, this could, of course, be appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada, but as we know, here in Canada, all courts have a history of making policy. We need to be very clear about that up front. The last time they did this in a hugely public manner was with their mandate that the government legalize assisted dying back in 2015. The decision, released on Wednesday by Justice Anne McDonald, ruled that the U.S. is no longer a safe country for refugees sent back from Canada due to risk of imprisonment. In particular, it's believed that the Safe Third Country Agreement is in violation of the rights guaranteed by Section 7 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms here in Canada. And Section 7 guarantees the right to life, liberty, and security of the person. Now, this decision that was handed down by the court will not take effect for 6 months, which means that during this time, the government will have to decide whether they appeal the decision to the Supreme Court or suspend the Safe Third Country Agreement. Now, as mentioned, this isn't the first time that the courts in Canada have shifted policy. And, you know, we need to be utterly clear at this point that the courts do have a political bias in Canada. People prefer to say that that doesn't exist, but we need to be honest and realize that that exists and it needs to be corrected at some point going forward. Now, looking at the numbers that are coming in post-pandemic, it already looks as though that the Trudeau government has made the decision to ignore the Safe Third Country Agreement. Sherry Aiken, an associate professor of law at Queen's University, said that it's her hope that there won't be an appeal and our government will do the right thing, and these are her own words, which would be to move quickly to suspend the Safe Third Country Agreement. Of course, the hope is also that Donald Trump will be defeated in the fall by Joe Biden and that a new administration will take over in January, marking a change in policy in the United States. The media and government officials here in Canada have, of course, loved beating on President Trump for his so-called inhumane and gross treatment of immigrants, as they have called it, though if you look back into the history of previous administrations, both the Bush administration and the Obama administration, you saw similar things happening. But in reality, though, he's just looking out for the national security of his country by means of strong borders in terms of his southern border. Now, this, of course, caused our Prime Minister to virtual signal mere days after Trump became president, which resulted in tens of thousands of illegal border crossers, or as the government calls them, irregular border crossers, coming into Canada. Now, pandemic or not, the government and media here in Canada has always been looking for an excuse to let those coming in from the U.S. into Canada to just show how much better we are than the U.S., in their view, of course. Now, this is where it gets absurd, because the Global News article on this subject asks, will Canada see an influx of asylum seekers? And the answer is yes, and quite honestly, this is a stupid question, because as we've already highlighted here, we have already brought into the tune of 58,000 plus illegal asylum seekers here in Canada. And now, I mean, it's a fair question to ask if there's going to be more, but to ask the question as if that hasn't happened yet, that's kind of skirting the issue. This article is quite honestly insulting to Canadians, as it's the usual trope of trying to import American problems and paint the U.S. president as a horrible human being. But the sad part about all of this, though, is it neglects our southern border and puts Canadians at risk so that the media can make the point that they have loved to make since 2017. As soon as our media and government adopt a Canada First perspective and realize that the cheap shots at the U.S. president, as encouraged by the Prime Minister and government, aren't helping Canadians, and that's only when things will start to turn around here in Canada for the better.
Yeah, this story has really gone back for the past 3.5 years that we've been doing the podcast for, and it's right from the very beginning of Trump's presidency. And it's the ability for these asylum seekers to skirt around the law and the rules to be able to get into Canada to take advantage of Canadian social programs. And the fact that the federal court does not believe that America is a safe country for these people to be in when they were safe for an indeterminate time before that, and only since Trump became president is America not safe. It begs the question as to why the federal court is intervening in this particular case, just due to a few very subset of cases that have happened. And I think this is a very worrying subject, because our government here has shown that they don't really care that much about the problem, and that even though they appointed a new minister, Bill Blair, to be the Minister of Border Safety since the last election, he's not really in charge of that anymore, and it doesn't seem like it's very much a priority of our government at all.
Yeah, and you know, we've seen in the past cases where the courts have become political. And, you know, we need to be entirely honest with people. It would be our preference that the courts not be political. But when it comes down to it, at the end of the day, if this is the game that's going to be played, if these courts are going to become politicized, the courts are opening themselves up to a situation in the future where a different government will come in and will make a series of political appointments as they see it to restore balance on the court. And if and when that happens, they will see that as a huge travesty of the justice system. But this has already been going on for years. And this is why, with this ruling, it is so important that this decision be appealed to the Supreme Court and the Supreme Court quash the ruling of the Federal Court of Appeal on this. Because if it doesn't, it opens up our judiciary here in Canada to becoming even more politicized and starting to resemble what the American judiciary looks like with their Supreme Court appointments. And there are many Canadians who would not like to see that happen. There are some that would, but it is my belief personally that the majority of them don't want to see that. And this is why this is a story that needs to be of national interest for all Canadians and should, of course, at this point, draw the eye of the federal government, in particular the Minister of Justice and the Attorney General, and this Minister of Border Security. But of course, we know what the federal government is up to, and we'll talk all about that in our firing line after. We're going to move on to another of our Canada stories right now, but before we do that, I'll just take a moment to remind our listeners about our Patreon page, which you can find at patreon.com/westerncontext, and that's where you can support the podcast monetarily if you want. For $2 a month at the price of a cup of coffee, you can help us remove media bias and sensationalism. For $5 a month, you can continue to help us do that, and you can have your name read out on the podcast if you want. And for $10 a month, you can become a Western Context insider. And in doing that, you'll gain an insight into our work and gain pre-release access to our production and show notes throughout the entire week. Now, when we reach $25 a month in contributions, we'll craft 2 Patreon-exclusive articles expanding on the coverage of our show stories from the month. These articles will continue to provide the context and information that you've come to expect from us. At $50 a month, you can expect a news and review podcast every other month where we'll reflect on the news of the month in a candid way and provide opinion on where affairs are headed next. Secondly, of course, if you want to make a one-time contribution as well, you can do that via PayPal. Just head on over to westerncontext.ca/support to learn more. All right, so moving on into our first Canada story, or our second Canada story, rather, here this week, we're going to talk about just when exactly the government possibly knew of the COVID-19 risk.
Yeah, exactly. Much has been made of the failures of the Canadian government's early response to the COVID-19 pandemic, with relying on faulty advice from the WHO, contradictory guidelines by Chief Medical Officer Theresa Tam, flip-flopping on the efficacy of masks, and the Prime Minister and several cabinet ministers openly flouting the health guidelines that they had set for all Canadians to follow. And what hasn't been talked about as much is just how early the Canadian government knew that something was wrong in China, and how much of an early response they could have had to save lives as well as the economy had action been taken sooner. Now, a little-known branch within Canadian Forces Intelligence Command, the Medical Intelligence Unit known as MEDINT, briefed Defense Minister Harjit Sajjan about the COVID-19 risk on January 17, 2020. The government confirmed in a document presented to Parliament earlier this week. Now, the briefing came 19 or 17 days after the World Health Organization China Country Office was informed of cases of pneumonia with an unknown cause in Wuhan in China's Hubei province. Now, while the minister was briefed in mid-January about the new virus, the government's incidence response group, led by the Prime Minister Justin Trudeau and composed of several cabinet ministers and other senior government officials, they didn't meet to discuss COVID-19 until 10 days later, on January 27th, and by that date, 82 people had died and more than 2,800 cases had been confirmed in mainland China, and more cases were being reported throughout the rest of Asia and around the world. Now, in response to an order paper question from Conservative MP James Bazin, the Department of National Defense, or DND, confirmed that MedInt had shared its briefing documents about COVID-19 widely with other government departments and agencies. He said, quote, "All relevant information and analysis was briefed to senior officials in a timely manner. The Minister of National Defense receives regular briefings to ensure the safety and security of Canadians as well as Canadian Armed Forces members at home and abroad." This is what the DND said in its response to Bazin. Now, while the actual contents of that military intelligence briefing are unknown, it's clear that the machinery of government was aware of COVID-19 and it spread well before the Public Health Agency of Canada had coordinated an almost complete shutdown of economic and social life 2 months later in mid-March. Now, Wesley Wark, who is a University of Ottawa professor and one of the country's top intelligence experts, said that the delay between the January 17th military briefing and the first meeting of the incident's response group shows, quote, "There weren't a lot of alarm bells ringing anywhere in government in the early days of the pandemic." And Wark said that the January 17th briefing to Seijian on the threat posed by COVID-19 to Canada, quote, "wasn't particularly early, given that China was already in the planning stages for the full lockdown of Hubei province that took place less than a week later." By the time cabinet and officials met on January 27th, Wark said that Western intelligence agencies had already known for weeks that there was a new virus ripping through Hubei province and beyond. Wark said, quote, "Canada, for reasons that go unexplained, missed the opportunity to do proper risk assessments, to seize the opportunity of early warning, and to get the response planning into gear. We lost a crucial period of time to take preparations before COVID-19 seriously struck in Canada. I think we have to assume that the wasted time cost Canada enormously in terms of lives and the economy." Now, what is known is that the contents of the January briefing to Seijian did not lead the federal government to close borders or to restrict flights or to alter its public messaging on the risk that the virus posed to Canadians. Thousands of travelers were still coming in through Canadian airports, many of them from China, none of whom were directed to quarantine, and nobody in the government was raising any eyebrows. Now, at the time, much of the government's focus in the early days of the pandemic was on repatriating Canadians from Hubei province and cruise ships, while international borders remained open with minimal screening. As late as March 10th, a department-drafted briefing note prepared for Health Minister Patty Hajdu ahead of question period was saying that, with just 12 cases being reported nationwide at that point, even though publicly available numbers had already climbed higher, it said that, quote, "the risk of spread of this virus within Canada remains low at this time." The note also said that public health system is, quote, "well equipped to contain cases coming from abroad, limiting the spread in Canada." A month later, Canada would have more than 21,000 cases, many of them linked to China, Europe, and U.S. travel. Now, as government documents show, as of January 28th, the World Health Organization was describing the risk of COVID-19 transmission as very high in China and high at the global level. It would be weeks before Canadian public health officials changed their risk assessment from low. Now, Wark says, quote, "there is a lot of explaining that I think the Canadian government needs to do as to why it held on to a low-risk judgment for so long until suddenly, on a Sunday in mid-March, we got all these cascading desperate measures and societal restrictions." Now, in other military news, Chief of Defense of the Canadian Armed Forces, Jonathan Vance, is announcing his retirement. This comes, interestingly, just one day after a new report released by Canada's Access to Information watchdog that says that she alerted Attorney General David Lametti last February that evidence covered in a systemic investigation into the DND information disclosure practices led her to believe that the military possibly broke the law while processing a request related to then Vice Admiral Mark Norman. Now, the decision also comes after the Liberal government declined to nominate Vance for the position of chairman for the of the Military Committee of NATO, which is the alliance's top military officer. While everyone in the media is praising Vance for his years of military service, it's clear that something wasn't right within the military command of Canada's armed forces. In September 2019, Vance was asked in an interview if he would continue as chief of defense staff if asked by the government to stay on, to which he replied, "I will. I still have a few things to get into the end zone. So yes, I will serve at the pleasure of government. That's what I do until I can't." Vance at the time said that he wanted to flesh out the growth that the military is to see in the future, and he believes that there is more work to be done on Operation Honor, which was the operation he initiated that was nicknamed by some in uniform as Operation Hop on Her, after it was discovered that there was widespread sexual assault and misconduct in the Canadian forces. Now, it's hard to know what spurred on his sudden retirement, but it's possible that there will be more revelations about the Mark Norman case that still haven't been uncovered yet.
And what you have here is you have an example of multiple things going wrong within the Canadian military. And, you know, from what we're seeing here on this perspective, it ultimately looks like it comes down to what was happening at the top level within the government ranks, as in, you know, the elected political branch of the military on this. And, you know, we have this Mark Norman case, something that the media should have aired out a lot more last year, but it really wasn't. It came out for a bit briefly, and then it disappeared quickly again. And then, you know, here we have this other report that if anybody else was in government, even if it was, you know, just for sake of argument, say if this was Jean Chrétien in the 90s and this came out, that his government had missed the ball on when military briefings were being given in relation to a pandemic, I think we would have seen even more questions from that then. And this all comes back to the point where the media has effectively become an operation that is opinion masquerading as fact. And because of that, Canadians aren't being served. And, you know, if there would have been more pressure back in January, maybe we could have closed our border sooner, and maybe we could have been in Australia in terms of handling the pandemic instead of what it's morphed into here within our country.
Yeah, exactly. Had they actually acted in time, or had they actually come out to the public and say, hey, this is what's going on, this is the information that we've received, there's a lot that we don't know yet, but we're taking preventative measures to make sure this doesn't hit Canada very hard, I think that a lot of people would have accepted that, and they would have agreed that something had needed to be done at the time. But instead, they were trying to say, oh no, that's not going to have a huge risk, our health system will be fine, and we'll be able to take care of anything that happens. And suddenly, a couple months later, everything hits the fan, and they can't actually withstand it, and they were forced everybody to go into a huge economic and social lockdown. And it just goes to show that there were the warning signs there, but for some reason they weren't followed. And as Wesley Work says, that was a huge error in what happened in the first warning system, and there's a lot that the government has to answer on that. And it's clear that there's something not right at the top of the military command, and it could lead into what's happening with Harjeet Sejan. It could be on the government side, it could be on the military side, but it's clear that something wasn't right there. And what's happening with Jonathan Vance is just clear that there's something that we don't know yet, and we may never know, given the nature of the military and classified documents. But I think it would be remiss of the media to let it go by the wayside and just say, oh, we don't see anything there, so that means nothing must be going on.
Yeah, and that would be very negligent, and it seems that, you know, we have some very good journalists in this country who are able to break stories, but when it comes down to what's actually presented to the population at the end of the day, that's not cutting it. It's not the way it used to be, and that has to change. And, you know, we saw this a lot during the time span of our next story, which, you know, is 2009 to 2015. And you're probably thinking, what happened during that time? Well, that was the time when all Western countries saw a huge increase in the number of terror attacks sponsored and carried out by those in part of the Islamic State and others. And this week it was announced that a Calgary man, Hussein Sabeh Borat, was charged with terrorism offenses for traveling to Syria and joining ISIS. He is said to have taken part in kidnappings on the behalf of ISIS, and the RCMP files suggest that the criminal was in ISIS between May of 2013 and June of 2014. Now, while the RCMP said he enlisted with IS, he received training for the purpose of enhancing the ability of IS. He knowingly participated or contributed to the activities of the group and knowingly committed the offense of kidnapping at the direction of or in the association of with the terrorist group. Now, the RCMP believe he left Syria on May 30th, 2014 through the Azaz border crossing heading into Lebanon. And from that point, he was freely able to return to Canada. Now, this highlights a lack of security screening on those heading to and from the Middle East. And Calgary Imam Syed Soharwadi, founder of the Muslims Against Terrorism organization and the Islamic Supreme Council of Canada, has long advocated Canada investigate those who travel abroad to join terrorist groups. And he estimates that there are probably about 200 Canadians that fit that bill. Now, Imam Syed Soharwadi called it a slow and tiring process to only have had one person be charged after 7 years. The imam spoke a great deal of sense, and all Canadians should ultimately listen to him. First, he called on those who have gone to fight with ISIS and then return walking time bombs. And he was aware of the fact that we shouldn't let them walk freely on Canadian soil once they return, which is something I think that many Canadians would agree with. But he also cautioned against the charges about potentially backfiring in the Muslim community, commenting that it would give those who hold Islamophobic views an opportunity to spew out hate. Now, Premier Jason Kenney on this had to say that it's important that law enforcement send a message that there's no immunity for Canadians who go abroad to commit acts of terrorism, to victimize the innocent, and in some cases, to also attack Canadian military personnel. And he ended by saying that I hope there are ongoing investigations because we do know there were dozens of Canadian so-called foreign fighters who went abroad to join ISIS and similarly deeply hateful terrorist organizations. Now, this is the entire point of this story right here. The fact that there have been a handful of charges laid in 5 to 7 years should be a question that all Canadians are asking about. Some of the questions that the media could start to ask the RCMP about on this include how many foreign fighters who went to fight with ISIS have returned to Canada, how many of them are under investigation, and are there any concerns that this might taint the perception of justice here in Canada. Now, thankfully, the influence of ISIS abroad is on the downswing, and we haven't seen any major attacks recently. Their geographical region that they control has been defeated or severely diminished, of course, but defeating an ideology takes time, and we aren't there yet. It's because of that we should be asking the hard questions while being aware that the threat from ISIS or similar groups could indeed flare up again in the future.
Yeah, exactly. It's not the point that ISIS was defeated. It's that ideologies cannot easily be defeated because they live in the minds of people. And after all, people's thoughts are one of the last bastions of freedom for people. And the fact that people can think whatever they want without necessarily acting on it is one of the great things about being a human being, of course. And the fact that the Canadian government is not really looking into these cases where there could be a lot of potential threats to Canada and potential people that may reoffend or re-radicalize, it just goes to show that this is another issue that the Canadian government isn't really that interested in, and it's something that a lot of people should be concerned about, and it's something that the media isn't really talking about very much.
Yeah, and you know, if there was going to be a way of ensuring that these folks coming back weren't a threat to Canada, you would, of course, have an RCMP-specific task force on this, but as far as we're aware, what's happened with this is a series of investigations, as you would have with any other crime. The crime in this case, of course, just happens to be terrorism. And, you know, it effectively puts it in with all of the other crimes that the RCMP is investigating. And in that respect, kind of diminishes it when other countries have entire task force dedicated to ensuring that their citizens who have went abroad and returned won't be causing a problem when they come back. And of course, one of these countries that does that is France. And, you know, many people don't think about France when they point towards criminal justice, but France has actually done a somewhat decent job on this file in this. And, you know, people love to import the problems of the United States, but we should be, of course, looking to other allies and friends in the world to solve this problem. And it's something that the media needs to be asking of the government and the RCMP, and they aren't.
Yeah, exactly. And this is something that they should be, and something that isn't happening. And looking to our allies is not something that this government is actually doing. As we've seen, they've diminished quite a bit on the world stage. They lost the Security Council seat at the UN, and increasingly Canada is not performing as well as it could be in the international regard. So it's something that should be looked at a little bit more. But again, the media hasn't been talking about it. It didn't even make national news that this was going on. And instead, they were talking about a different story altogether that was not really out of the news very much, but it seems every day goes on, we find out more about it. And that's in our firing line, which is the story we talk about that either receives too much media attention, not enough, or not the right amount, or is just plain ridiculous. And I think this story actually, in some regards, refers to all of that. And that is that it's talking more about the Wii scandal, and that's more and more things that we've heard about that every single day. And 2 weeks ago, when we first detailed the Wii scandal, almost as a footnote, we mentioned journalist Brian Lilly of the Toronto Sun, who was contacted by Wii Charity's defamation lawyer in response to questions about Wii's vast Canadian real estate holdings and how he felt that it was odd that he was hearing from a lawyer to standard media questions into the company. And now we know exactly why Wii's response to Lilly was so harsh and defensive, like a cornered wolf. Now, both a government and charity official confirmed the controversial Canada Student Service Grant contract was not actually with Wii Charity, as Prime Minister Trudeau had earlier announced. Rather, Trudeau's government had awarded the contract to run the $912 million student volunteer program to the Wii Charity Foundation, which is actually a distinct charity from Wii Charity. It's little more than a shell corporation with no assets, no history, and no record of charitable work. It was even described by Wii as inactive as early as August 2018, and only received federal charity status in April of 2019, and whose stated purpose was to hold tens of millions worth of Wii charity real estate. Now, how it became the vehicle for the government's sole source contract for the student volunteer program, which has embroiled the Prime Minister in an ethics scandal and has triggered committee meetings, has raised lots of questions over the past few weeks. And this decision has immediately attracted attention, as it was unclear why the civil service could not perform the task allocated to the charity. Now, almost every day there's new information uncovered, and it's likely we haven't finished seeing the end of the level of corruption engaged by the Liberals with Wii Charity. Now, in his statements on the Canadian Student Service Grant, Trudeau has said that it was to be administered by Wii Charity. But late Tuesday, Minister of Diversity and Inclusion and Youth Minister Bartosz Chagger's office had confirmed that the government had actually contracted the Wii Charity Foundation. Now, to reiterate, Wii Charity and Wii Charity Foundation are in fact different charities. In CRA documents, the Wii Charity Foundation said that it's not a branch, section, or division of any other charity, but the two organizations still have the same Toronto address and phone number, which actually points to an address that is held within the downtown Toronto riding that is held by Finance Minister Bill Morneau. Now, a Weed Charity statement said that it decided to make the foundation the contracting party with the government on the advice of its lawyers due to concerns about legal liabilities stemming from the federal student program. The statement said, quote, "The use of multiple corporate entities to isolate liabilities for particular projects is not uncommon. This action was done with the advice of legal counsel and with the consent of the board of directors. We Charity Council proposed that We Charity Foundation be the party to the funding agreements in part to protect We Charity's pre-existing charitable assets, which are needed to continue to deliver We Charity's long-standing charitable programs. The We Charity Board of Directors is structured to provide governance and legal oversight over the We Charity Foundation." So in essence, they were trying to cover their own asses. And in the end, if there was a legal liability that was too much, they could just claim that it was part of the We Charity Foundation and that there was no assets that the government could draw on. But what of the government's acquiescence? Charity lawyer Mark Bloomberg said that it was shocking that the Trudeau government provided the $912 million student service grant to the We Charity Foundation and not We Charity. He said that if We Charity Foundation had been unable to complete the student volunteer program, the government would have little recourse to recover any of the funds. He says, quote, "It is close to useless to obtain an indemnity from a charity with no assets. I can understand why We Charity would want this agreement without potential exposure to be in the name of the We Charity Foundation, but I cannot understand if the government was protecting the interests of taxpayers or citizens, why the government would agree to this or incorrectly state who the correct party is to this very important agreement." Now, the Weed Charity has also been accused by a witness in the House of Commons Finance Committee of transferring personal data to the Liberal Party before the 2015 election. Speaking in the Finance Committee, journalist Vivian Krause accused the Weed organization of engaging in data mining for corporate partners, some of which was later given to the Liberal Party in 2015, who ended up winning a majority in that election. Now, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau's mother and brother have earned a combined $300,000 in speaking fees from We Charity. And the ties between the Trudeau government and We Charity don't just stop at speaking fees given to members of Trudeau's family, though. Finance Minister Bill Morneau, for instance, had two children who either worked for the charity or were promoted by it. Katie Telford, who works as Trudeau's chief of staff, created a charity that raised funds on behalf of WE, and Minister O'Regan served as that charity's honorary head. Now, neither Trudeau, O'Regan, Morneau, or Telford recused themselves from the decision to award the charity this contract, which would have seen WE receive more than $43.5 million to oversee the program. Now, this has led to an investigation by the Ethics Commissioner, and if Trudeau is found guilty, this would be his third ethics violation. Now, on Tuesday, Clerk of the Privy Council Ian Shugart said that he couldn't see not having the Finance Minister and the Prime Minister involved in discussions about a program as big as this scope and price as the Canadian Student Service Grant. Now, Bill Morneau is also in hot water and facing calls to resign after telling MPs that he cut a check for over $41,000 to expenses incurred by the WE organization relating to two 2017 trips that his family took with an organization that he, quote, forgot to repay. Morneau has said that after conducting a review of his finances in recent days, he found documentation confirming that he had already repaid $52,000 in expenses for hotels and flights related to the trips to Ecuador and Kenya to view the organization's humanitarian work, but he failed to locate receipts relating to the WE programming that he and his family members participated in during the trips. Morneau has also said that his family has made two donations totaling $100,000 to the WE charity, one in April of 2018 and one in June of this year, to support the charitable organization's work with students in Canada and for COVID-19 relief in Kenya, respectively. NDP ethics critic Charlie Angus says that the ethics commissioner should investigate Bill Morneau again after the new travel expenses revelations. Ethics Commissioner Mario Dion already had launched an investigation into Morneau for not recusing himself from the government's decision to award the contract to WE to administer the Summer Students Grants Program, as his daughter works for the charity. Now, Conservative finance critic Pierre Poilievre says that Canadians will find it hard to believe that Morneau didn't know about thousands of dollars of travel expenses that the organization covered, particularly since he's a cabinet minister forbidden from accepting such a benefit. Poilievre referred to the decision on the student grant program. He said, quote, "We know that this is illegal. We know that you ought to have recused yourself. Minister, you've lost the moral authority to hold your office." Now, at this stage of the WE scandal, it might be more efficient if we were to ask which leading members of Justin Trudeau's cabinet are not in some relationship with the founders of WE Charity, Mark and Craig Kielberger, either have not been speakers at WE events, did not receive complimentary vacation at WE's hideously expensive $4,000 per night luxury resort in Kenya, or do not have family members working for WE, or have not forgotten that they owe a woeful chunk of change to some arm of WE's ever so numerous enterprises. Now, Waterloo MP and Minister for Diversity and Inclusion and Youth, Bardis Chagger, says that she takes responsibility for the now dissolved contract between the government and WE Charity. I mean, WE Charity Foundation, as we found out. The junior minister and Justin Trudeau's government has been called out by both backbench MPs and Finance Minister Bill Morneau as the person behind the problematic WE contract. Now, Morneau told members of the Finance Committee Wednesday that he was, quote, "not the minister responsible, as I had outlined in my prepared remarks. That was Minister Chagger," he said. Now, it's yet another example of Trudeau's feminist government throwing yet another minority woman under the bus just to keep the wealthy white guys happy. It looks exactly like a repeat of what they did with Jody Wilson-Raybould. Poilievre said on Thursday, quote, "I feel badly for Minister Chagger. It's disgusting the way she is being treated." And he's not wrong, because Chagger, as the Minister for Diversity, Youth and Inclusion, is a ministry without a department, and technically Chagger reports to Heritage Minister Stephen Guilbeault as a subset of his department. Now, the program that would have seen WE get this contract was out of the Employment and Social Development Department, which is under two ministers, Carla Quattrall and Ahmed Hussein, and there's very little that Chagger could have done on this file without the ministers above her, including Morneau, giving direction. Poilievre says that it's clear who to blame for the WE Charity mess. Quote, "The men responsible for this are Bill Morneau and Justin Trudeau. For them to try and blame a junior minister who had no authority to do any of this is absolutely disgusting." And it should also be noted that WE's headquarters are in Morneau's riding, and no contribution or contract of this size would go to an organization in this senior minister's riding without their knowledge and approval. Morneau's daughter was also working for WE at the time that he voted on and signed the contract, and he supported this contract despite deep family ties that include taking trips, as well as his wife and another daughter being deeply involved. Taking free trips is a direct violation of the Conflict of Interest Act, which means he broke the law. And while Morneau tried to convince the committee and the Canadian public that not paying for the trip was just a simple oversight, WE has confirmed in a statement that the trip was actually a complimentary one, the kind that they usually give to big donors. Now, if there were any ministerial accountability left, Morneau would have tabled his resignation already. Sadly, there is not, and the Liberals appear to be circling the wagons around their finance minister, with several making supportive statements on Thursday and blaming Chagger instead. Now, they shouldn't be publicly backing Morneau. They should be calling the Prime Minister and telling Trudeau that he needs a new finance minister. And if Trudeau is guilty of a third ethics violation, then he should resign as well. And that is what would happen in an ethical government, but it doesn't look like we have one of those. And the question on everyone's mind at this point, even those probably supporting the Liberal government, is what were they thinking? How could they be so obtuse, so blind, and so careless? Well, really, it has a lot to do with distance. The distance between those who rule, who have lived with power and money all their lives, just like Bill Morneau and Justin Trudeau, and those who are ruled, everyday citizens who keep this country running and have never breathed in the attitudes of the rich and powerful. Between those who have never or rarely faced challenges and those whose lives are in the most part defined by challenges, the rich and powerful reside on a different plane or even a different planet. Those long possessed of great fortunes have lived a different life, one that has absolved them from the messy imperatives and the daily humiliations faced by the ever so numerous people who are just getting by. These are the types of people that would just forget to repay a $41,000 vacation and then just casually cut a check to repay it right away. $41,000 is the retirement fund for a lot of people, and normal people can't just do that. Real people worry about the end of the month. There are still people in this country who worry about the light bill, the heating bill, the phone bill, rent, mortgages, car payments, the monthly reminders of living close to the margin. Normal people ration their phone calls or data. They seek the bargain items in the supermarket. They keep the thermostat low. They save scrupulously so that they have a place to live at the end of the month. These are normal people's problems, and Trudeau and Morneau don't worry about these problems. They don't know what normal people like us have to deal with. They are out of touch, and they have been for a long time. And we're only just now scratching the surface of just how much they don't represent Canada and Canadians.
And, you know, this was all entirely on display from that moment when the Trudeau government took power in 2015, when we saw what his cabinet looked like, and he uttered those words, because it's 2015, the virtue signaling, the consistent displays of we're having a gender-balanced cabinet, but the people in this cabinet who have been consistently thrown under the bus have been the women of the cabinet. And, you know, this is a prime opportunity for a political party such as the NDP to come and attack Trudeau on this. I don't know where the NDP is. It feels like from watching this that Charlie Angus is the leader and not Jagmeet Singh, but that's of course a topic for a different day. And, you know, we go back to what things looked like prior to 2015. We had, of course, Thomas Mulcair as leader of the NDP. Before him, we had Jack Layton. And, you know, if we looked at that and we looked at what either of those two individuals would have had to say on this, I think they would have had an absolute skewering of Trudeau and Morneau this week. Because if you look back to the NDP of those years, that's precisely what they stood up against. These kind of people in government fighting for the everyday voter. And, you know, that seemingly disappeared. And it's an opportunity that the NDP should, of course, take note of because we are in a minority government situation. And with that, we also need to tell people the big difference between this and the SNC and the Aga Khan investigation that went through committees. The difference this time is that the opposition holds the majority on the committee. So it's up to the opposition this time entirely if the government manages to skirt away from this one as they did in the past. Because if the opposition decides that they want to keep this going until Christmas, they could very well do that. It's going to be up to them. And what happens with this, whether accountability is brought forward, is actually going to be up to the official opposition this time.
Yeah, exactly. It seems like the Conservatives are wanting to continue the investigations in this, but we haven't really heard from the Bloc on this matter. We haven't really heard from the NDP on this matter. And as we said, we heard one little blurb from Charlie Angus on the matter, but not very much otherwise. And as you said, the NDP used to fight for the common man, the common worker, poorer people, people that, you know, worried about regular things to get by. And it seems like they're not as concerned about that as they should be. And they don't seem to realize that over the last two elections, Liberals have completely stolen their platform and then enacted none of it. And it seems like this is a golden opportunity for the NDP to say, hey, these people are out of touch. They aren't worried about you. We're concerned about what's going on. We're going to hold them to account. But we haven't heard anything about them on this, and their leader has been completely absent. And it seems to be up to the Conservatives to do the dirty work that the NDP should be doing. And it's interesting how we've seen a complete role reversal in the last couple of years from the NDP on this regard. And as you've said, you know, Trudeau and Morneau, they're at the very top. It's quite clear that they knew about this. And as you said, these ethics scandals are much easier to explain to Canadians. They're much easier to see what exactly went wrong, you know. When it came to the Aga Khan and gifts like that, you know, it's one thing. Whereas this is many different things all happening together. It's a cascade of dominoes that we haven't even seen the end of. And I think that the fact that Trudeau and Morneau and all the other cabinet ministers that are involved with We Charity did not actually recuse themselves from these discussions and did not see that there was anything wrong with what their behavior was just goes to show that they are not aware of what should be happening in government. And I think that leads us nicely into our word of the week, which this week is the word recuse, which we've used several times in the last story, and that is to excuse oneself from a case because of a potential conflict of interest or a lack of impartiality. And it's quite clear from all of the family ties, all of the money heading back and forth, all of the free trips, that neither Morneau nor Trudeau have a impartiality when it comes to We Charity, and that they are quite clearly in a conflict of interest. And we will see if the ethics commissioner will be agreeing with that stance when he releases his report.
Indeed. And, you know, this is a big story. We thought last year with SNC-Lavalin, something that touched the rule of law in Canada, that was as big as you could get. But this is even bigger. And, you know, this makes the sponsorship scandal, as we mentioned, the sponsorship scandal of the early 2000s look relatively small. And the one difference here that we'll give to those old liberals of, you know, the Jean Chrétien types and the Martin types, they were honest. They said what they did. These guys are skirting the issue and they're throwing their diverse, gender-balanced cabinet members under the bus with this. And that makes it even worse. And, you know, if they had just recused themselves, we wouldn't be in this situation here, and maybe we wouldn't be having this discussion. But nonetheless, recuse is a good word of the week to wrap this show up. And if you want to find full supplementals about anything else that we've talked about in any of these stories, you can do that by visiting westerncontext.ca for the full show notes. You can also subscribe to the podcast on any number of podcast listeners out there by visiting westerncontext.ca/subscribe. We're on iTunes, Pocket Cast, Google, Stitcher, practically anything under the sun. You can also, of course, find our stories and more in the shows posted on social media, on Twitter and Facebook, at Western Context each and every week. So with that being said, we'll be back next week for another episode of Western Context.
And we'll always make sure to look through all the stories that the media is talking about and a lot that they aren't talking about, and even some that they're not talking about correctly, or they're not digging into the stories deeper to find the actual truth of what's going on. And we'll do this in order to provide you with the context needed to put yourselves on the right side of the news. So with that said, we will see you next week for another episode of Western Context.